From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Coming up on today's show, the local Catholic diocese is beginning to track reports of child abuse.
The bishops were forced into the corner and they needed to act because they knew that they had not been protecting children as they should have been.
Visit a local center for genealogical research and hear about new trends in researching your family tree. Plus, a local sexual assault case disappears from the courts.
What really fell apart were the victims and the victims' families. They're the ones that actually absolutely destroyed this case.
And the latest in our creative couples comes to us from the theater world.
So lovely, so perfectly huggable.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news.
I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
The local Roman Catholic diocese has attracted worldwide attention for its problems with child abuse, particularly because of Bishop Robert Finn, who is the first and only U.S. bishop to be convicted of failing to report suspected abuse. Later this month, the Diocese Office of Child and Youth Protection will release its second annual report on abuse in the parishes. The report is one of several big steps the diocese has taken in recent years to address abuse. But as Casey Currents' Alex Smith reports, some say these steps aren't enough.
Yes, please. Thank you.
In the northern end of downtown Kansas City, Missouri, employees of the local diocese and Catholic Charities come to work in a 19th-century brick and brownstone high-rise. Workers here quietly carry out the administrative work for a diocese that serves over 130,000. But even among these faithful employees, there's anger at the church. In a meeting room, Jennifer Valenti remembers the upset that she shared with millions when she learned about the sexual abuse scandals.
I grew up Catholic, and, you know, I watched this scandal unfold nationally, and now it's unfolding worldwide. And there are many times that I was disappointed about the way it was handled.
In early 2011, a scandal hit Kansas City in a big way when reports emerged showing that Father Sean Radigan had produced child pornography and that Bishop Finn may have known about it. Revelations of the scandal caused local Catholics to demand that their church do more to protect children. So in June of 2011, the diocese took an unusual step. It hired the first ever ombudsman in a U.S. diocese.
This is Jennifer Valenti, ombudsman for the Diocese of Kansas City, St. Joseph. If you believe that a child is at risk, please call the Missouri Child Abuse Hotline at 1-800.
Jennifer Valenti is a former Jackson County prosecutor. As ombudsman, she investigates reports of what she calls boundary violations. Reports of known child abuse are directed to police or social services. Boundary violations happen when a diocese employee or volunteer acts suspiciously toward a child, but it's not enough to warrant an investigation by the police or social services.
Let's say that both those agencies say there's nothing there for us to look into. Then I would look into that and say, okay, is there abuse happening in that situation, or is that somebody who doesn't understand what a good boundary is? Is that somebody who doesn't understand that we don't do that? We don't put ourselves in situations where we're alone with children in a private area.
Valenti then takes her findings to an independent review board. It's made up of lay people who work in child protection.
That group oversees the work that I do. They supervise the work that I do, in fact. In an investigation, I report my findings to them, and if they want further investigation, then I do it. That group of professionals provides a recommendation to the bishop as to somebody's suitability of ministry.
Jennifer Valenti is part of a five-person team that serves as the Diocese Office of Child and Youth Protection. In addition to the ombudsman role, the Kansas City St. Joe office offers training to spot abuse, a victim advocate, and a counseling coordinator. While the ombudsman position is unique, child protection offices like Kansas City's are now common in most U.S. dioceses. On a slow morning at the Midtown newsroom of the National Catholic Reporter, editor Dennis Cody explains how these offices got their start after a major child abuse scandal in Boston, which became big news in 2002.
The bishops were forced into the corner and they needed to act because they knew that they had not been protecting children as they should have been. And they, the the public pressure, pressure from the pews, forced them to act and to develop a plan, a credible plan of protecting children and removing priest abusers.
Following the scandal, U.S. bishops established a national office of child and youth protection. The bishops developed a charter that set up standards for each diocese to follow. These include creating positions like a victim advocate and safe environment training, as well as creating local child protection offices. Kansas City St. Joe has been in compliance with the 2002 charter every year, even in the year of its biggest scandal.
2 years ago, when the Father Radigan case broke here in the local scene, that year the Kansas City St. Joseph Diocese passed this audit. They were found to be in compliance with the charter. And so the question is, well, you know, if they're in compliance with the charter, but this is happening, what does that mean?
For many area Catholics, it meant the diocese needed to go beyond the charter and do more to protect children. In addition to creating the ombudsman role, the diocese began creating annual reports on child abuse. In its first report, which covered the year starting in July 2011, the diocese revealed 79 reports of suspected child abuse or boundary violations in areas both inside and outside of its jurisdiction. 7 of these cases were substantiated, and 14 people were suspended or removed from service. For a Catholic diocese, the reports that Ombudsman Jennifer Valenti produces are a big step in transparency, but critics say the diocese needs to do more.
Valenti put out some numbers, but disclosing numbers protects no one. Disclosing the wrongdoers, that protects the vulnerable.
That's David Clossy from his office in St. Louis. He's the executive director of the Survivors Network for Those Abused by Priests, or SNAP. His organization has long considered Kansas City St. Joseph to be one of the worst U.S. dioceses for abuse. Clossy believes that in order to deter child abusers, the diocese should name names and provide more to the public than an annual report.
Valenti should speak up every single time, immediately, when a credible child sex abuse report is made. It helps predators. Every time Valenti and other Catholic officials save up information about child sex abuse for one report at the end of the year, every single day that a child molester or possible child molester is protected and kept in secrecy, gives that person more time and incentive to destroy evidence, intimidate witnesses, scare victims, discredit whistleblowers, and potentially even flee the country.
Jennifer Valenti says that in some cases, the diocese does do more than the annual report. Anytime an abuse allegation is made against a priest, the public is informed. But naming names, particularly those of lay people, is more complicated.
There are some people that are credibly accused that are employees, and so you can understand from a legal standpoint that that's not something that, I mean, I think most people wouldn't expect that names would be published until there's a criminal proceeding. So if there's a criminal proceeding, that is something that we would share.
Despite the efforts that the Kansas City St. Joseph Diocese has made to address abuse and bolster its Office of Child and Youth Protection, David Clossy of SNAP is still not impressed.
These offices look good and sound good on paper and in principle. But the sad, simple truth is that these offices are one more effort by Catholic bishops to try to handle child sex abuse internally.
Clossy remains suspicious of the diocese and of the bishop's motives for revamping the Child Protection Office.
This is part of a very carefully orchestrated and very shrewd, you know, public relations campaign to convince parishioners and the public that bishops are reforming.
Jennifer Valenti says she's proud of the work her office does and believes the transparency of the office can help rebuild trust. But she understands the skepticism that many feel about her work and the department she's part of.
It was sometimes a surprise to me to know that people perhaps would question my integrity or question my motives or question my bias and whether I have a bias. And so that's something that I've just had to deal with. And I think that's okay as a Catholic and as a mother, I think it's okay. I want everybody to be on the same page about how we protect our children, and I want everyone to feel comfortable with the work that I do. And the reality is that, you know, there's going to be times that people just aren't, that people just don't support the work that we do, and I think that comes out of hurt and anger, and I think that's oftentimes legitimate.
The National Catholic Reporter's Dennis Cody thinks the church has a long way to go in dealing with child abuse, but thinks the enhancements Kansas City St. Joe has made to its child protection efforts will help the diocese to stay vigilant.
What Kansas City did by putting high-level, professional, experienced people in is probably a good, you know, marker for other dioceses, just to make sure that the professionalism is at the highest level and that it's going to be an ongoing concern.
The bells of the Cathedral of the Immaculate Conception ring out across the western end of downtown as office workers rush to get lunch. The Mother Church of the Diocese has a dome covered in 23-karat gold leaf, which can be spotted from miles away. Just after noon, a few churchgoers scurry inside for the weekday mass. For most of them, the main question about child abuse efforts is, are they actually reducing abuse? Valenti says she's seen a slight tick down in the past year, but it's probably too soon to say what the real effect is. That's because, as Dennis Cody explains, most victims usually don't report abuse until years after it's happened.
What we're told by advocates for sex abuse victims is that it's going to take 10, 15, 20 years after abuse happens before most victims can face up to it and report it.
The Diocese of Kansas City St. Joseph will release its second public report on abuse later this month. You'll be able to hear about it here on Casey Current. I'm Alex Smith.
So, who are we? African American? Japanese with a dash of Polish, English, Cherokee topped off with some Lebanese. From Jamestown to Angel Island, where many Asians arrived in California, Americans have been tracing their family lines for years. But recently there's been an explosion of interest. At least that's what some local experts say. Casey Current's Ryan Schisler has this story of how technology is fueling modern genealogy, how we're finding our place in history, and how the search is uncovering more surprises than ever before.
Ask any genealogist. They'll say researching family history begins and ends with stories.
She had never heard of him, didn't even know about him.
For 100 years, it was in Yorkshire, a little town called Giggleswick.
Half of my pedigree is German. We were German farmers that came over.
And it's called the Fuimono family reunion. And it's our 73rd years.
These stories and more are all being told over and over again at a library in Independence. But if you're there, all you'll hear is this.
This is the largest freestanding public genealogy library in the United States.
Cheryl Lang is the manager of the Midwest Genealogy Center. The 53,000-square-foot center is fairly new, relatively speaking. It opened in 2008. It's part of the Mid-Continent Public Library, which Lang says has a long history of supporting genealogy research. She gave me a tour of the center, the same one anyone could ask for when they arrived.
It's from floor to ceiling of, or almost ceiling, of nothing but microfilm.
And each of these Lang estimates the center alone has 750,000 microfilm images, most of which are only available there. The center also has books, an archive of genealogy magazines from around the country, historical maps, and digital resources like a subscription to Ancestry.com. They also have a small army of volunteers that are constantly digitalizing books, holding seminars. There's even a woman who can translate documents written in old German dialects.
Let me take you into here. This is our rare book room. Climate-controlled room, and it's for the books that are more fragile and that we don't want to put up on the open stack.
Lang calls this her dream job. She's been researching her family history for over 30 years and is a librarian by training. Over those three decades, she's seen firsthand the changes in genealogy, mostly in the past few years.
I'm very big in my Facebook group.
Kathleen Brandt has her own company called A3 Genealogy.
But I'm also big in Twitter and Google+ and LinkedIn and Pinterest. Yeah. So those are just a few. And it's amazing how many followers you get, plus, of course, our blogs.
Brandt has found new technologies to be helpful in family history research, especially among certain demographics where the traditional paper trail of census records, land ownership, and other forms of documentation may not be as helpful. For example, look at the descendants of American slaves. Before the Civil War, most African Americans didn't take last names and were not counted in the census. The advent of DNA testing allows individuals to find genetic matches not only to other people in the United States, but also to populations in Africa. Most tests compare your DNA to samples taken from around the world.
And that is why I use a lot of DNA on my African-American clients.
About 10% of Brandt's clients are African-American. An African-American herself, she took the test for those same reasons. For her, this scientific approach turned up a few surprises, like it has for so many others.
We were shocked to find so much Irish on my mother's side and on the free color side.
DNA may be the newest and maybe the most definitive scientific approach, but it isn't the only modern advancement in genealogy. The internet has made resources available to anyone with a connection, says another genealogist, Beth Folk.
Because we're in this age of easily accessible technology that makes accessing records so much easier, you don't have to go to the microfilm to get started. The barrier to entry is just nominal. You can get started and you can find your way around and get records and really get your feet wet and get excited about it so much easier than you used to be able to.
It's that nominal barrier that has drawn more people to genealogy, including a rising number of young people, Folk says. So long as there are living people, there will be those researching their family history. I got out and walked around the library. It wasn't packed, but there were a considerable number of people there for a weekday afternoon. Carrie Barger, a woman in her 30s or 40s, is sitting at a desk between two bookshelves. She has documents strewn in front of her, a binder thick with paper, and a few maps laid out. It's only her first time at the center, but she's already been working for over half a year.
All of these pieces of paper I've gotten from the internet. Everything up to this point I have found online, and I have quite a wealth of information.
Barger says she used websites like FamilySearch.org and Ancestry.com to get started. These are the tools genealogists say are breaking the barrier to the entry of research. But they're also bringing people together to collaborate, even reunite. Krista Cowan is a head genealogist with Ancestry.com.
Not just records that are coming online, of course, but it's people that are connecting online. We see people making connections every single day with second and third cousins, fourth cousins. They're finding pictures of grandparents and great-grandparents that they've never seen before, that they never knew they were related to.
Cowan says social media is also playing an integral role in connecting people, information sharing, and even bringing families back together. Midwest Genealogy Center manager Cheryl Lang reconnected with a Dutch branch of her family on Facebook. I even was able to find my relatives in Germany the same way. But what is the future of genealogy? What will our descendants look for when they look for us? Krista Cowan.
Oh my goodness, I don't even know. If you think back, 30 years ago when Ancestry.com was started as this ancestry publishing company, and just look at what we've done in the last 30 years, looking forward, even if we just continued on that trend, that's really exciting to me, to know that more records are going to become available, to know that more people are going to be connected, to know that more areas of the world might be opened up.
Genealogist Beth Folk also anticipates that today's social changes will create new challenges for future generations.
The other thing that the next two, three generations are going to have to challenge with is the changing definition of the family unit. Okay.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah, can you imagine doing a family tree where you not only have blended families, but you've got two mothers or two fathers?
Exactly.
Whole new challenge.
So if you find yourself digging through piles of books looking for your great-grandfather Johann or trying to figure out where Grandma Louise was born, maybe think about holding on to those family photos, expired driver's licenses, or plane tickets you use today. Your descendants may thank you one day. For Casey Currents, I'm Ryan Schisler.
Coming up, hear about a sexual assault case that has divided community members in Maryville. You're listening to Casey Currents.
I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. It's made national news several times in the last year. Almost the same story, different places. A drunk high school girl is raped. The attack is amplified by viral videos and social media. Some of the boys accused of the acts are investigated. And in one of the most famous cases, two football players were convicted in Steubenville, Ohio.
A similar case has now come up in Maryville, Missouri, about 2 hours north of Kansas City. But unlike the others, this case seemed to disappear as quickly as it erupted, leaving a town talking, law enforcement under question, and two girls dealing with very grown-up problems. Casey Current's Monica Sandretsky headed up to Albany, Missouri to talk with the girl who survived the alleged assault. Just a warning to our listeners, this story contains some explicit content and profane language.
In the back bathroom of their home in small town Maryville, Missouri, 16-year-old Daisy Coleman and her younger brother Tristan stroke a few mewing kittens.
We named them after rock stars.
This is always.
Their mom, Melinda Coleman, is a veterinarian in town and brings animals home to nurse them. Daisy steps out of the bathroom and shrugs to perk up a black kitten with pneumonia resting on her shoulder. This is the house where Daisy and her three brothers grew up.
In Albany, everyone kind of knew me since I was a baby. We all grew up in diapers together, basically.
But a couple of years ago, Daisy's dad, a doctor in town, was killed in a car accident while Daisy was in the car with him. It devastated the whole family, so they moved to Maryville to, as they say, escape the pain. At school, her older brothers were champion wrestlers. Daisy was a flyer on the cheer squad. But one night last January soured the Coleman's fresh start. The first thing Daisy remembers from that night is her surprise she was still alive.
I was just like, I thought I was dead at first. I was really confused. I was like, what is happening? Like, I couldn't even make sense of anything.
January 8th, 2012. It was 5 a.m. Daisy was lying on the front yard of her family's home in Maryville. The then 14-year-old had been outside about 3 hours, unconscious in freezing temperatures. She wasn't wearing shoes or a jacket, just a t-shirt and sweatpants. Her hair was wet and frozen. She couldn't speak and was barely able to crawl. Her mom, Melinda, and younger brother, Tristan, found her after she dragged herself, crying, to the front door. They were almost as confused as Daisy was.
It almost sounded like somebody just falling against the door. I kept thinking, did she sleepwalk?
Yeah.
Or, you know, and she had absolutely no idea.
Melinda's first worry was that Daisy's feet were frostbitten, so she began to put her daughter in a cool bath, hoping to warm her up slowly. As she removed Daisy's pants, Melinda Coleman found bruises and red marks.
And I asked her if she hurt, and she said yes.
Did you see bruises and stuff? Like,
Yeah. And really, really red marks and stuff.
That's when Melinda called 911. After talking with law enforcement, they left for the hospital. The story came out in bits and pieces over the next few hours. The night before, Daisy and a 13-year-old friend she thought of as her little sister had a sleepover at the Coleman's house.
I can't exactly remember most of the night, so it's not going to be much of a story. But what I do remember is me and my friend were drinking in my bedroom without my mom's permission. And then this guy texted me and he's like, hey, you want to hang out? And I was like, well, I'll have to sneak around. It's like 1 a.m.
The guy who texted with Daisy was Matthew Barnett, a 17-year-old who was friends with Daisy's older brother, Charlie. Daisy's mom said she knew Barnett pretty well, along with three other boys we'll mention later.
Four of the boys that were involved were, we thought, Charlie's friends. They played football with him and wrestled with him, and they'd been at our house watching the playoffs. In fact, I'd made chili for him a few nights before.
Charlie says these guys called themselves the Wolf Pack, a reference to the movie The Hangover 2.
It was before school even started when the Wolf Pack thing happened my senior year. Like, it was just a group of them that were friends, and I think The Hangover 2 came out that summer, and they were just obsessed with the movie, so they all made shirts, tie-dye shirts, or had them made with their names on the back, and I think it just went from there.
Melinda says Charlie had told Daisy to keep away from Barnett. But that night in January, Matthew Barnett drove over to the Colemans after their texting conversation and picked up Daisy and her friend, along with another young guy who was underage. They snuck into Barnett's parents' home through a basement window, joining the other three guys from the Wolf Pack, and Daisy continued drinking, using a glass that has since become infamous.
Excuse my language. But they called it the Bitch Cup, and it's a really, really tall shot glass. I think it had, like, lines, like, if you drank that much, you were, like, some rank or whatever. Like, I don't know, you're like a B-word if you only take, like, half of it or something.
The rest of the story from that night is told in Nottoway County Sheriff's reports. As Daisy continued drinking, her friend and the underage boy went into one of the bedrooms. Barnett admitted to having sex with Daisy in another room, but said she wasn't drunk yet, just buzzed, as he put it. Another boy, 17-year-old Jordan Zeck, told investigators that he used a buddy's iPhone to video Barnett and Daisy kissing, half undressed. Barnett, Zeck, and two other boys said they all watched the video, then deleted it. The younger girl and the boys later told sheriff's investigators that Daisy was incoherent and had to be carried back out the window of the Barnett's basement. And Melinda says that start to finish, the event didn't take long.
We found out later from the text messaging and from the phone calls, they picked the girls up just a few minutes before 1, and they dropped them off by 2. So they were pretty efficient. They knew what they were doing.
The boys drove the girls back to the Colemans, throwing a condom out the window along the way. The boys told the younger girl to go inside, and they propped Daisy up against the house as she was vomiting and deposited her purse, shoes, and a cell phone. It was 3 hours before Daisy's mom and younger brother found her and took her to the hospital. The hospital ran a rape kit on Daisy that morning, but the Colemans say they've never seen the results. By that afternoon, Sheriff Darren White says Barnett admitted to having consensual sex with Daisy, and Zek confessed to the cell phone taping.
I was pretty happy with it because we had what I considered to be a very serious crime, and within a matter of a few hours, we had warrants for their arrest, and they had been arrested. That's a pretty good day.
The underage boy with Daisy's friend admitted to rape and was charged and later convicted in the juvenile system. But in Missouri, 17-year-olds are considered to be adults in the criminal justice system. So Barnett was charged with a felony for sexual assault and a misdemeanor for child endangerment. Zek was also charged with a felony for sexual exploitation of a minor because he admitted to the videotaping. When news spread that these two athletes from Maryville High School had been arrested and charged in Daisy's assault, it was the talk of the town. But town residents wouldn't talk with KCUR. We tried to interview almost a dozen residents, but almost everyone was hesitant to speak with us. Pat Giffen, a nurse at the hospital Daisy went to, did say that people in Maryville tend to take sides on community issues.
Any acts that we may feel strongly about in either direction, positive or negative, our community does kind of band together and react.
How they reacted, she wouldn't say. One local man would only say that the whole town was upset. The local papers and TV news posted mugshots of Barnett and Zek once they were charged. But 2 months later, the case was suddenly over.
Charges are dropped against two Maryville teens accused in a sexual assault case. The Nottoway County prosecutor dismissed a felony sexual assault charge against Matthew Barnett and a felony exploitation of a minor charge against Jordan Zek.
Already, the Coleman family felt like people in town were against them. Daisy and two of her brothers say they were taunted at school. They were threatened on Facebook and Twitter, called terrible names. The Colemans say the iPhone video the boys made that night passed around school, then suddenly disappeared, and law enforcement officials say they couldn't retrieve it. Daisy learned on Facebook the charges were dropped.
After that, I was really, really angry, and I kind of, like, took it out on Facebook, which I shouldn't have at all. But at the time, it was kind of like I felt like the world was against me, and you have to stand up for yourself.
If people in Maryville weren't forthcoming with KCUR, many were on social media. Friends of Barnett and Zek celebrated their release on Twitter with a hashtag of Jordan and Matt are free. A woman unknown to the Colemans and angry that the charges were dropped created a Change.org petition urging the state attorney general to investigate the sheriff and prosecuting attorney. More than 1,200 people signed it. But if things were tense in town, the relationship between the Colemans and law enforcement was even worse. At his office in Nottoway County, Sheriff Darren White is irritated, saying the Colemans undermined the case on social media.
What really fell apart were the victims and the victims' families. They're the ones that actually absolutely destroyed this case, all on their own, all by themselves. At least the suspects were smart enough to keep their mouths shut after it all happened.
The sheriff accuses Melinda of being hostile and uncooperative. Melinda Colemans says she felt scared by the anger shown by a sheriff's department that had turned against her. At one point, the Colemans did refuse to cooperate, but later changed their minds and were interviewed.
There was probably a lot of things I didn't do exactly right, but I just didn't know.
But despite his frustration with the Colemans, Sheriff Darren White is clear about what happened that night.
Did a crime occur? Hell yes, it occurred. Was it a horrible crime? Yes, it was a horrible crime. And did these boys need to be punished for it? Absolutely.
Upon concluding that investigation, it was clear and obvious that there was not a criminal offense to be prosecuted.
That's Robert Rice, Nottoway County prosecutor. He's the one who decided to drop the charges against the two boys and says social media had no part in his decision. Rice says the teenager's behavior was, in his words, incorrigible. But he says he had insufficient evidence to move forward with the case. So what was missing? Rice won't go into specifics to the case. Just to say Barnett's admission to consensual sex isn't enough to convict him.
Whenever you're dealing with sexual assault in general, it takes more than that. You have to have a person that will testify under oath, subject to cross-examination, to say that we had some sort of sexual contact, whatever it is, and I did not give my consent. At the end of the day, if you don't have that basic, simple, but fundamental element, you don't have a case, period. And there's not a darn thing you can do about it. And that's just in general. That's not referring to any specific case in any way whatsoever.
So then what were the missing elements here?
I'm not going to comment on what was missing, and I'm sorry.
Melinda and Daisy completed a deposition, and the Colemans say they were willing to testify in court. There have been rumors about why the case was dropped. Some of the talk in town centered on the Barnett family's political ties, his grandfather's a state representative. But both Rice and Sheriff White deny any connection, saying that's absurd.
You make your decision based on what you know and based on what you can prove. And you know, I sleep well at night knowing that the right thing, I did the right thing.
The boys declined to comment for this story after numerous calls to them. One attorney responded, Robert Sundell, who represented Barnett. He says the investigation and witness statements disprove Daisy's claims. Barnett and Zek have since graduated, but the girls? Well, they're not friends anymore. Daisy has had a particularly tough time. The girl who used to be an athlete and dancer, who won local beauty pageants, is now cutting herself, and she's attempted suicide several times.
I was cutting, and I would, light up a pin and put it against my skin as burning, so... I just felt like if I'm this ugly on the inside, I might as well look it on the outside, you know? You're the S word, you're the W word, B word. Just after a while, you start to believe it.
And the 13-year-old girl who was with Daisy that night? The boy who sexually assaulted her, also underage, made a plea bargain and spent several months in a juvenile facility. But the girl's mom, who didn't want to be identified, says her daughter still suffers nightmares and flashbacks. That she's aged too much for a 15-year-old. The mom misses the two girls she knew before that January night in 2012.
They were sparkly. You know, they just lit up a room wherever they went, and they were so much fun. And, you know, neither one of them has that anymore.
Now, the Colemans have moved back to their home in Albany to escape the pain for a second time. They sit around the kitchen table, coffee mugs in hand, still haunted by the trauma and ripple effects of the last year and a half. Charlie is angry his brother had to go to a smaller school with fewer athletic opportunities. And Melinda still feels a sense of injustice over the way she thinks law enforcement handled the case.
They're not saving these boys by not punishing them for this. You know, at least they would have the opportunity to change and do better if they were punished. So it's not that we hate them, but it makes it awful hard to move on.
As for Daisy, she's getting psychiatric treatment. She journals regularly, but she misses her old life before that night in January.
I really, really miss Maryville because it was pretty good there. The cheer squad was really good. I really enjoyed flying. I was really good friends with a lot of the people on the cheer squad, and Albany doesn't fly very well, so I didn't really get to fly this year.
For Casey Currents, I'm Monica Sandreski.
This story leaves us with a lot of questions, the main one being, of course, why exactly was the case dropped? And perhaps more importantly, why do similar cases keep happening all over the country? And how do teenage boys and girls, men and women, define sexual assault and rape? For a better understanding of the issue, we turn now to Kim Lonsway, research director at the organization End Violence Against Women International. We called her at her office at San Luis Obispo, California. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. I'm pleased to be here.
So what's your reaction to the story that we just heard? How typical is this kind of case in the United States?
I hesitate to use the word typical, but I will say that there are certainly some of the dynamics that are tragically common. Adolescent victim is a very common scenario. Perpetrator suspect who's several years older, also very common. Of course, alcohol use is very pervasive in sexual assault cases. Some of the other dynamics that I think in this case that are increasingly common in our modern era here, we seem to be seeing an increase. We think there's not necessarily data to back this up, but pretty much anyone in the field will tell you that we seem to be seeing more cases involving multiple perpetrators and multiple victims. There's just more people involved. Taking a video, that's an increasingly common element. And, of course, the social media fallout afterwards, which can be absolutely devastating. We're seeing story and story, again, breaking the news in terms of that social media devastation that wreaks on victims and families that results in a whole cascade of self-harm and suicidality and many of those victims who move, as we saw in this case as well.
So I have to ask you, I mean, this is a situation, teens getting drunk at a party, a guy takes advantage of a girl, it hits social media, as you say. Some people think this is sort of becoming a national epidemic. It's been in the news a lot, scenarios like this. Is it?
Whether or not it would meet the definition of epidemic, I'm not sure. You'd have to ask a public health person, but certainly we're seeing, again, more and more of these common elements. You know, teenagers have long gone out drinking and gotten into trouble, but they do seem to be different now in terms of the sexual victimization that we're seeing. And, you know, the phrase that you use in terms of a boy taking advantage of a girl, you know, that's sort of how people like to think about this. But I think when we look at least the facts that I've seen, and I won't make a judgment on this particular case, but based on what I've seen reported in the media, if these facts are true, really speak to a callous disregard for the well-being of this person that goes well beyond sort of a 1950s characterization of someone being taken advantage of.
Well, so how does the definition of rape or sexual assault change, or does it, in different parts of the country in terms of norms in various communities, et cetera?
Well, yeah, there's two parts to what you asked. The one is the definition of rape, which is a legal one, of course, and then the second one is how is that perceived in communities, and those don't map on, as I'm sure you can imagine. And I did actually look into Missouri law a little bit. You know, we work on a national level, so I see state laws across the country, and, you know, conceptually, in terms of what is the definition of rape, I think there is a great deal of misunderstanding about that. There are two kinds of rape, in some sense, that are the most common. The one is forcible, which is what people tend to think of when you think of the word, which is a sexual act that's committed using force, threat, or fear, you know, however that is defined in state law. So it's a sexual act committed with force or threat. The second type of rape is when a sexual act is committed against someone who is unable to consent. And there might be a variety of reasons for that. You know, age is certainly one of those elements. Someone who is severely disabled to the point where they cannot understand the act, et cetera. You know, we're not talking about someone who is blind, but someone whose severe disability means that they cannot legally consent. And in that category of incapacitation or inability to consent, then we also have the type of rape that is, you know, someone is unable to consent because of their incapacitation due to drugs or alcohol. And that exists in some form, you know, in most state laws. I did notice Missouri is one of the few states where there's sort of an exemption that it is only a rape by forcible compulsion if that substance, the drug or alcohol, is administered by someone else without the victim's knowledge or consent. That is a gap in some states' laws, and Missouri seems to be one of those. I mean, I would see it as a significant gap in the law that says if you drank yourself and you are incapacitated, you know, no crime. But if someone else gives you the drugs and you're incapacitated, then it is a crime. It sort of doesn't make sense on some level. Either you're able to consent or you're not, and how you got there is really irrelevant. You can see how sort of the victim blaming is really built into that law.
So what are some of the myths surrounding rape and sexual assault?
People tend to think in terms of what sexual assault is and when it happens, you know, in terms of what is consent and that consent is, you know, so difficult to establish or gray areas. You know, we hear a lot about that, and I suspect there's a lot of that conversation going around this case of, you know, is it consent, is it not, how can we possibly know? And I think on the one hand, yes, there is a lot of confusion on that. On the other hand, I think sometimes when we look at the facts of these cases, it really isn't as unclear as we sometimes make it out to be. So, for example, there's a body of research on sexual assault perpetrators, and the way they talk about what they're doing, they are aware that the victim is saying no or crying or making excuses or trying to, you know, squirm away, whatever it is. They see that behavior. They just don't care. So it's not a matter of, you know, because in their mind, this person consented to the sex 2 hours ago when they put that skirt on or, you know, whatever. In their head, they consented already, so their behavior now is irrelevant.
Some of these incidents around the country beg the question, is there a kind of a rape culture in some teen communities in the United States? And if so, what's that about?
Right. Far broader than teen communities. Teens are just echoing what they see in the adult communities, I think. Many people have talked for a long time about the existence of a rape culture, and I think once you start looking for that and seeing that, you know, it's as if you put the glasses on and can see it, and now you can't unsee it anymore. We are surrounded by images that, you know, women exist for sex, that women essentially want sex all the time, that, you know, we say no, but we really mean yes. And you can't talk about those media messages without now, sadly, really talking about pornography. The existence, the prevalence of pornography is astonishing in terms of how many people participate in pornography and how many teens in particular, that's the source of their information on sex. That's where they learn what sex is. And that's terrifying when we look at what the messages of what today's pornography is sending. It's not, again, it's not the 1950s pornography. This is very much an imagery around sexual aggression, not just being acceptable, but being desired, that's what women want.
How does social media play a role in this, if there is such a thing as a rape culture? How does it play a role?
It can magnify it. It can normalize it. You know, human behavior, you know, we look around at each other to see what's acceptable. And now all of a sudden, you know, we can see far beyond just the people that are standing in the room with us. We can see, you know, people everywhere who are engaging in social media. So we look around to see what's okay. And yet at the same time, it's such a depersonalized sort of environment, free of consequences. Behaviors can get more outrageous. And so it can kind of magnify, I think, what may already exist. I think that does also play a role, you know, with the taking the videos and the posting and all of that. It becomes this much more public act. And one of the things we're seeing among victims is the rape now doesn't end when the rape ends. Now with social media, you know, literally the video may be circulated and played so that the rape goes on and on and on and on. But then the backlash that we see in these communities, you know, again, especially among adolescents, where and in small towns and in other closed communities, people take sides, they have passionate opinions. The level of, you know, torment and name-calling and all of that is something we're really seeing happening quite a bit. And so, again, it's as if the rape doesn't end when it ends anymore. It goes on and on and on.
How do you deal with the issue of prevention without sounding like you're blaming the victim? Because, you know, there's always people when they hear these cases who talk about, well, yes, there were perpetrators, but the victim wasn't very smart either in terms of some behaviors he or she engaged in.
Right, right. I think people do find that tricky. And again, I do quite a bit of training, and I have a PowerPoint that I've put together. And I specifically use it with police and prosecutors because they see rape cases so often, and it's just slide after slide after slide of people engaging in fairly high-risk behaviors. And I ask them, you know, how many of these end in a rape, basically? And the typical answer is all of them. They just are convinced that all of these have ended in a rape. And the reality is that none of them did, and that I put the slides together on a Friday afternoon with contributions from my friends and family members. You know, these are regular, professional, healthy people who have all, you know, done silly things in their past. And so I think on one level it's helpful to remember none of us is as perfect as we like to think we are. We're very quick to judge others for behaviors that maybe we didn't do that exact same one, but we were vulnerable in a very similar way. Particularly when we're young, although not exclusively. So I think that's just a reminder to ourselves about throwing stones and all of that. I think the other piece of the prevention puzzle that has been really promising lately is the role of bystanders, and people may have heard of this, that in terms of prevention programming, we are focusing a great deal not just on the perpetrator. It might be very hard to stop that person who is motivated to sexually assault. It may be much easier to reach the person next to them. And again, this is you know, sort of ties in with the social media. Given that there are more people around, we need to prepare those folks to listen to their gut that tells them something's not right and feel the courage to do something. And that, I think, is one of the most promising aspects of this field, is that is an easier task to equip those folks, all of us, when we see behaviors that we're not sure. Again, humans, we look around to say, nobody else is doing anything, so this must be okay, to equip us to think ahead, to prepare ourselves with the strength to put a stop to it.
Kim Lonsway is the Director of Research with the organization End Violence Against Women International. I thank you so much for your time.
Excellent. Thank you.
After the break, the next in our series in Kansas City's Creative Couples. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. And now, the latest in our series on Kansas City's creative couples. The series is inspired by the work of iconic Mexican artists Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera, which is on display this summer at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. Kahlo and Rivera had a famously tempestuous relationship, which sometimes inspired their art. As for this next couple, imagine a room filled with drag queens, burlesque performers, and cage dancers. This isn't the stage at some late-night club, but rather the entertainment at the wedding reception of Ron McGee and John Fulton Adams 6 years ago. KCUR intern Claire McInerney tells us about their creative relationship.
Ron McGee and John Fulton Adams' house reminds me of the set of an old horror movie. Chestnut 1884, as they call her, is an old Victorian-style home in the historic Northeast. The house is a strong reflection to their styles as artists. Ron McGee is an actor, director, playwright, and staple in the Kansas City theater scene. His husband, John Fulton Adams, is a costume and clothing designer. The two are giving me a tour of some of their favorite things around their house.
This is our cabinet of curiosities. And what you fill it with is bones and bottles and different things that make us happy.
There's taxidermy in every room. Most of the time, the animals are wearing a hat or a scarf. And, as any good host, Ron keeps offering me something to drink.
Do you guys want a swig of moonshine from Kentucky?
John describes the vibe of the house perfectly and why they decorate it the way they do.
I'm so used to being in and around theaters that I feel the need to live, in a way, on a set.
And for two people who thrive on the dramatic, both say they were shocked when they found themselves wanting to settle down with each other. After they got married 6 years ago, a ceremony not recognized by the state but significant to their relationship, the two moved into a house and are now raising two dogs and three chickens together.
Ladies, let's get you some food. You want to come inside?
John said he didn't believe in soulmates until he met Ron, and neither imagined they'd crave watching Stephen King and Bruce Willis movies at night. But the two weren't always so comfortable with each other. In fact, Ron's first impression of John was really negative.
I thought he was stuck up and mean.
John didn't feel the same way, though. He was intrigued by Ron after their unique meeting at a benefit.
And I started to set my glass down, and from the middle of the table, a voice came that said, "Get your glass off my dress. I've got to perform. I'm going on." And I looked up, and the centerpiece was Ron McGee, and he was dressed as a table.
But since you can't judge a book by its cover, or a table by its centerpiece, the two ended up dating. But for two intensely creative people, dating someone else with similar passion can backfire. John dated many other artists and describes the negative effect these relationships had on both his personal life and his work.
A lot of people I've dated have not understood my creative drive. It's gone from not supporting to completely trying to squelch it.
Ron also struggled when dating other actors, but describes him and John's working relationship to be as cohesive and complementary as the romantic one.
One great thing is his design world is backstage and mine's on stage, so we can mesh together easier.
This ability to learn from one another has intertwined their professional and personal lives. Both Ron and John agree that once they met each other, their respective art careers were influenced by the other. Ron will incorporate inside jokes, like the couple's love of Red Lobster, into a play he's writing. And John has costumed many of Ron's shows, using design he knows that they both will love. And now that they are settled into their marriage, Ron and John praise the Kansas City art community for helping them with this life they've created together. Both have lived in different places and agree that Kansas City is the best place to practice their art. After living in expensive cities, Ron enjoys how cheap it is to live here, because he can focus on his acting career and not stress about money. John has a different connection with the city and its art community, which stems from a rocky relationship with his family a few years ago. When Ron and John got married, nobody from John's side of the family attended.
That community is it's our chosen family. If you look at our wedding pictures, we had jazz players and burlesque dancers and dominatrixes and drag queens. But when I look at the picture, I just see brothers and sisters.
And in addition to their art family in Kansas City, both Ron and John can't imagine creating their art and sharing their passion without the other.
And in theater and in art world, at times I feel it's a very lonely world.
And why do you say that?
Because you're giving your all to people. When you step on stage, you should be giving 110%, and that's 350 people plus, or how many's in your audience, 50, whatever, is taking that energy from you. And if you don't have someone to give back to you, it can be very lonely. So I don't feel alone anymore. Also, we have two dogs and two chickens, and that helps too.
John is currently working on a high-end couture line he hopes to launch in September, while still working at Churchill and teaching costuming at William Jewell. Ron just finished Lyle the Crocodile at the Coterie, where he starred as Mr. Grumps, who had a passionate love of his own for his beloved cat.
So love-lovey-dovely, so perfectly huggable, soft and snuggable, love-lovey-dovely, so gentle and cuddlish.
For Casey Currents, this is Claire McInerney.
Like peaches and cream, we two are a team. I feel so befuddlish. My dear, my sweetie, my loyal companion. When I'm with you, I sing with such reckless abandon. Lovey-dovely, when push comes to shovely, I'll protect you.
See photos of Ron McGee and John Fulton Adams in their home and at work, and find more stories of Kansas City's creative couples on our website, kcur.org.
Thanks for tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kccurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Sylvia with associate producer Alex Smith. Our interns are Ryan Schisler and Monica Sandretsky.
This was Ryan's last week with us. We appreciate all his help in putting the show together and the fascinating stories he reported for us, from the controversies in the world of paddlefish caviar to this week's story about genealogy.
Ryan will be in his senior year at the journalism program at Mizzou. We look forward to hearing him on the airwaves in the future. So all the best, Ryan. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.